Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another exciting episode we have here today of Crime and Science Radio, today with very special guest, Dr. Lee Goff. So now, without any further ado, let's hit it right off here with our hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. We have a fantastic guest today. I know you're going to love hearing all about this. This is Dr. M. Lee Goff. He's one of the founding members of the American Board of Forensic Entomology, and he's also professor emeritus in forensic sciences at the Chaminade University of Hawaii. I hope I said that right. And he was the person who really helped establish and was a director of the forensic sciences program there. He also worked for the University of Hawaii, has just this amazing career. You'll see his full bio on our website. And he's been involved for over 25 years in helping to helping the local law enforcement and understand how insects can tell us more about what went on at a crime scene. So, welcome, Dr. Goff.
Yeah, aloha.
Good to be here.
How you doing?
Great to have you.
So our listeners are familiar with the term forensic, but they may not all know entomologists, and we'll get into some of the specifics later on. But just in general, what do entomologists and forensic entomologists do?
Yeah, well, start off with really a definition of entomology or entomologist, because strictly speaking, entomology is the study of insects, and it's a particular group of arthropods. Animals having an external skeleton and jointed legs. And basically for the insects, you have three major body regions. They have six legs, and the vast majority of them have either one or two pairs of wings. Everybody's encountered them, your ants, your houseflies, bees, wasps, things like this. It gets a little more complicated in that the discipline gets expanded in practice to where we also deal with organisms that aren't strictly insects but will be closely related. So entomologists also typically will deal with things like ticks, mites, spiders, centipedes. Sometimes it seems like anything nobody or no one really wants to work on, okay, let's pass it to the entomologist. And Monday mornings when I was at University of Hawaii, my desk looked like kind of a catch-all of everything that went through, including sometimes rats and slugs and things of this nature. It had nothing to do with insects. Now, forensic entomology is kind of a subspecialty. Probably the majority of entomologists actually work with agriculture, because insects are direct competitors for food. So we're actually fighting for our meals with the insects. But forensic entomology actually is, broadly speaking, any time insects become evidence or involved in legal matters. And we break this down into two or three subspecialties, depending on how you want to look at it. The first would be stored product. You know, everybody's encountered this at some point or another. You get up at 6 in the morning and you pour a bowl of cereal, and as you're reaching for the milk, you know, half the bowl of cereal walks away because insects got in and they're doing a better job eating your breakfast than you are. And typically you don't like this, and so you get very upset and you'll either throw it away or more frequently you'll take the box back to the store and you'll want your money back or another box of cereal. I'd strongly suggest going for your money back, because if you want another box of cereal, you got to go to the same shelf. So I have the box that was sitting right there, and, you know, what are the chances you're going to be there, you know, the next morning with the same problem again? But generally what happens is at some point or another, somebody wants to recoup their losses, and an entomologist gets called in, and he has to figure out who didn't do what they were supposed to, how did this contamination occur. Okay, so that's one area, and we'd call that the stored product. Now, another one is structural, and this is the one that, well, it's a perennial favorite here in Hawaii. I mean, we got a termite problem you wouldn't believe, and, you know, as you're building your new house and they don't treat properly, by the time you're hanging the front door, the back of your house has fallen down because termites got in. And you go to the contractor, who then goes to the subcontractor, who goes to the sub-subcontractor. And eventually, an entomologist comes in to determine basically who's got to pay in there, who didn't do what they were supposed to. Okay, now sometimes these two are lumped into kind of a broad category of urban entomology, okay, even though not all of it is urban. Okay, I don't like either one of these, really, because it's kind of greed versus greed. You know, you don't really want just a new box of cereal. You want a new box of cereal and, you know, $3 million in damages because of psychological trauma because you looked at insects at 6 in the morning. And you may have a pretty good chance of collecting that. I'm not sure. The third area is the one I work in. This is the so-called medical criminal or medical legal forensic entomology. And here a crime has been committed. Insects have become evidence, and the entomologist is in to assist in the analysis of this evidence, putting together a little small piece of the puzzle. And it's going to be used by the police and by the legal system to isolate and successfully or unsuccessfully prosecute. Now, keep in mind that the evidence and the analysis is kind of a two-edged sword. The evidence may serve to assist in the conviction. The evidence, when properly analyzed, may also serve to exonerate. And so this is kind of a quick little outline of entomology and forensic entomology.
Well, so that our listeners can get to know you a little better, tell us about your life before you became a forensic entomologist. What drew you to the study of insects and other arthropods?
Okay, well, I guess I could best describe my career as an accident in there. And you'll hear that word a lot. In fact, it was so accidental at Chaminade at one point they asked me to give a talk to a group of students on how to plan your career. Okay, only once. Okay, at the end of that talk, they asked me to never talk to students about that again. But I actually started off not with entomology. My initial interests were more marine, and I was interested in the marine biology, specifically pelagic urochordates. Salpa is a good example of that. And these are things that really have virtually no economic value, and you don't really get paid a lot to look at them in there. I was in California, Los Angeles, and decided actually to come surfing one summer over here in Hawaii, and never quite left. And I went to University of Hawaii, did my undergraduate work there, and I got my bachelor's degree in 1966. And at the time, I was putting myself through school by playing guitar and singing in there. And it's kind of handicapped by the fact I really don't have a singing voice, and I really don't play a very good guitar at all. But this was the 60s, and so, you know, actually nobody noticed. You could do almost anything you wanted to as long as you had your hair kind of long, and you were safe doing that. But I didn't have a real steady source of income. So, basically I was a folk singer, and that was not really that big in Waikiki. A real stretch to turn that into Hawaiian music. No. Plus, I tend to be a little bit sarcastic, and that wasn't working too well either. But I actually needed a somewhat permanent sort of a job, and there was an ad in the paper from the Bishop Museum out here, and they were looking for somebody in marine biology, and side thing said they wanted somebody to volunteer in entomology. So I went out, applied for the job. They took a look at me and didn't run, but they came close to it. I was wearing a fur vest at the time. And so I just passed around from one person to the other, and they kept asking me what I knew about insects, and I kept saying nothing. You know, just what I know, my knowledge of insects. Now, can we talk about the urochordates, or can we talk about coleopterates? You know, something marine. And finally, I was put up to meet with this guy, and he looks at me, and he says, well, I'll tell you what. He says, if you got nerve enough to apply for a job for which you have absolutely no qualifications, I'll hire you and see what happens. And I says, what do you mean no qualifications? I mean, I'm a senior zoology at University of Hawaii, and I'm pretty well versed in the marine groups over here. And he says, yeah, but this is to work on mosquitoes. Turned out there was a misprint in the paper, and they were paying in entomology, and they wanted to volunteer in marine biology. Well, I was a little bit on the hungry side, so I developed a sudden interest in entomology. And I worked for Wally Steffen, who later turned out to be a very good friend. We did a lot together over the years. But came to work and got fascinated by the mosquitoes. I thought they were really fantastic little beasts. Went ahead, graduated, and I decided that... okay, I think I'll change for my master's. I think I'll major in entomology. Well, very simply, the Army had other ideas, and I was drafted. You know, I didn't have a really stellar career in the ROTC program at UH, which at the time was required in there. So got to the end of the Army. They didn't know what to do with me. Basically, I had a bachelor's degree in zoology, and so... finally wound up in pathology laboratories and spent most of my 2 years looking at dead things, assisting in autopsies, cutting up things, learning to make slides. And it was actually a very interesting 2 years. Learned probably more anatomy there than I ever learned at the university. Mm-hmm. I got out, went back to the museum to reclaim my job, and discovered the job had disappeared. But there was a guy working there on mites. He needed an assistant. I knew nothing about mites, so I figured I was as qualified for that as I was for the mosquito job, and I took that, and I got interested in mites, and actually wound up doing my master's degree at Cal State Long Beach, and later my PhD back at University of Hawaii working on trombiculid mites. Yeah, there. So it was... basically, the whole thing. My career's been kind of one fortuitous accident after another.
So you were basically a chigger wrangler.
Yeah. Well, we prefer chigger picker.
Yeah. Trust me, I know all about them. I grew up in the South, and we found all kinds of ways to get chiggers out of your skin. And then, of course, my mom painted me with Mercurochrome after that. So I glowed in the dark and probably got mercury poisoning, but that's another issue. It probably explains a lot. So how did you move from that into studying insects from death scenes?
You remember that accident word I used earlier? it was another accident, basically. I went to an Entomological Society of America meeting in San Diego. And this was at the Town and Country Hotel, which is, they had that kind of freeway loop that you can come around and you can't really get across it too well. But I couldn't afford to stay in the meeting hotel, so I was staying at another hotel across the loop, which meant it was a pretty long walk getting there in the morning, so I tended to go over and stay there. Well, a good friend of mine and another individual from Cal State Long Beach, Bill Wren, was due to give a talk very early in the morning on chiggers. So I got up very early and dutifully made my trek around to the meeting hall. And the problem was that Bill lives in North Dakota, and this was December. So his flight was delayed, and he wasn't there. And I was sitting there, and I did not feel like walking back around to the hotel. But next door, Lamar Meek was giving a paper on his, I think at that point, his first or second case in forensic entomology. So rather than walk back around, I walked in to listen to his talk, basically to kill time. And as I sat there watching his talk and also watching the other members of the audience, some of whom had also come over to see Bill's talk, everything was going fine until he started putting pictures up of decomposed bodies. And at that point, the audience started making this rapid rush. I think two were trampled trying to get out the door. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, this is kind of interesting. And from working in the morgue during my military time, I basically had a pretty good idea of dead bodies. And so I thought, this might work. I know the entomology. I'm used to dead bodies. So after the meetings, I got back to Hawaii, and I contacted our medical examiner, who at the time was Charlie Odom, and decided I'd try and sell him on the idea. Now, he had a wonderful secretary because she screened all of his calls. And if you call up the medical examiner saying you want to look at maggots on dead bodies and maybe talk to him about it, they decide you're kind of nuts. So for a couple of months, Charlie was out to lunch, according to her. You know, I don't care what time of day I called, he was out to lunch. We finally got together in a place over here called the Willows, and we figured if we could have curry and rice and talk about maggots, we'd probably get along. And so Charlie started working with me on it, and pretty much it developed from that.
Well, in one of your books, A Fly for the Prosecution, you cite some examples of forensic entomology dating back as far as the 13th century, but we actually know that it's a much more modern, at least in our current forensic framework. And you were instrumental in the beginnings of all of this. Tell us a little bit about that, how this discipline actually came into existence and developed into what it is.
Yeah, well, I was actually part of a group that more or less, I think, came together as a result of Lamar Meek's talk, and also some earlier work, which was done by Bernie Greenberg up in Chicago. Yeah, which actually, to me, was very amusing because during my master's, I revised a genus Odontocerus, and one of the things that I did was to basically revise Bernie Greenberg's master's. At that point, the genus was Acomatacerus, but I wasn't connecting the dots for quite some time, and I thought it was kind of interesting. Then all of a sudden it dawns on me, this guy that maybe 20 years earlier was working on chiggers was now also the guy I was kind of following working in the forensic entomology. We both had a pretty good laugh about that. He didn't take it too badly that I had sunk most of his new species and said they weren't in there, but, you know, that worked out. But let's see, I think Lamar and Paul Katz from up at the University of Washington assembled a workshop for the Entomological Society of America. And I was just kind of getting interested, so I wasn't really part of the workshop, but I attended it, and then we all kind of got together for lunch afterwards and started talking about things. And the group kind of hit a critical mass. Paul used to refer to us as the Dirty Dozen. We did actually have 12 members in there, and really the only criteria for being part of this group was being able to discuss dead bodies and have lunch at the same time in there. And this gave rise to the Council of American Forensic Entomologists, or as we called it, CAFE. It was probably more descriptive of where we met than anything else that happened, because we met in different cafes around the country in association with the Entomological Society meetings. Eventually, this gave rise to the American Board of Forensic Entomology a number of years later. We did produce a book. It's called Entomology and Death, the Procedural Guide, and this was designed to be something to assist law enforcement in going out to process a scene, what to do when they found insects. there. Now, about the same time, I also started working with Charlie Odom. Well, we were actually going and doing a few cases and finally got one that we thought was really interesting. And we decided to make it as a presentation for the National Association of Medical Examiners. And we went down and did kind of a tag team presentation on that. I think we should have worn straw hats and boaters or something like that, the way we were going. But at that meeting, I encountered Bill Rodriguez. And Bill's a forensic anthropologist, again, a very good friend. I'd already encountered Wayne Lord through the Entomological Society. Wayne was with the Air Force at the time, and he later shifted and became a supervisory special agent with the FBI there. And the three of us hit it off pretty well. In about 1989, we actually started giving workshops, and this was with the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. I had initially been really interested in joining the National Association of Medical Examiners, but as Charlie Odom and several others pointed out to me, I didn't have qualifications to be a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners in any way, shape, or form. That didn't stop me. I did ultimately become an affiliate member of the National Association of Medical Examiners. Actually, Paul Katz, Wayne Lord, and I think to this day are the only ones that ever actually joined that. But you have the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and this is something that covers a much broader spectrum of forensic concerns. They have a number of different sections, and I joined the pathology-biology section, and Wayne also joined that. We have a number of people now in entomology who have joined the academy. But the three of us, Wayne, Bill, and I, decided to put on a workshop, and we combined the entomology and anthropology. This is around 1989, ironically in the same hotel that I had first encountered it, which is the Town and Country Hotel there in San Diego. We thought we'd have maybe about 25 or 30 people for this workshop. We were somewhat surprised at the level of interest we got. We wound up with well over 170 people showing up, and this idea we had of having a group of people sitting around and passing the specimens around with a somewhat informal sort of presentation. Now, that kind of went to pieces, so we gave a more formal presentation. Very well received. And actually, we gave it in alternate years and wound up being the longest running workshop in the Academy history. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. In fact, we gave it at the international entomology meetings in Los Angeles. And we also gave it down in San Antonio, Texas, which a lot of people were very unhappy about that one. It was the centennial celebration of the society, and they had a whole group of dignitaries and speakers, and they scheduled our workshop at one of the times when they had one of their main plenary speakers. That was a mistake, it turned out. We had not only standing room, we had people out in the hallway. There were probably well over 200 people who attended this. And I took a break and I walked down the hall. The plenary speaker that they had spent a lot of time getting in had something like 10 people in the room. We were not really popular in there. But,
I attended the one in L.A., the International Academy. It's a fantastic workshop. I can understand why you got 200 people in there. It was a great workshop. Probably one of the best I've ever been to.
Yeah, we actually gave out some course evaluations, and one of the evaluators, I always love it, they said that the presenters behave more like a group of high school or middle school students on a field trip. We knew each other's presentations so well by then. If somebody didn't make it, then we'd go ahead and do it.
Well, we're going to take a very brief break, and then we'll be back to talk more with Dr. Legoff about forensic entomology.
Everybody, here's what we're going to tell you about some of the new radio shows and the things that we have going on right here on Suspense Radio. We are, of course, Suspense Magazine, and we are one of the only magazines, or the only one that I know of that's in the genre that will be able to bring these great radio shows to you. And what we have are, of course, we always have Crime and Science Radio that runs every other Saturday, and that is with Doug Lyle and Jan Burke, with guests that are on there from forensics to police to FBI to CIA, to just a lot of different stories and things that you're going to hear about real-life police work, along with what goes on in CSI studios, labs, police thefts, courtrooms, anything and everything you can think of that has to go here with crime and science. Then, of course, we have our main show of Suspense Radio, which is the every other Saturday from Crime and Science Radio. This is where you're going to hear different kinds of authors, from New York Times, number one best-selling authors, all the way to debuts that are just kind of trying to get their name out there. We're going to interview them, we're going to talk to them, we're going to get inside their head, we're going to get inside their book, we're going to bring them straight to you so you have a better understanding of exactly who you're buying, what the author is, and exactly what they're doing. Now, we come to our two newest shows, which is The Story Blender, which is hosted by Stephen James and Jose Castillo. This is where the art of storytelling comes into play. Every other Friday, you're going to hear The Story Blender. You're going to hear such guests as David Morrell has been on the show so far. Joe Castillo has been on the show. Robert Dugani. We have a lot more coming up with Steve Barry and some other fabulous guests. This is where story taking is taken to the next level. How to create a story. How a story becomes one. When you're talking from the very beginning and how to tell it so when someone reads it, they understand it. You're going to learn from masters. So authors and fans and readers or whoever need to be listening to just kind of get, of course, authors, you're going to be able to understand and listen from the masters for free on exactly how stories kind of conceptualize and get themselves going. Then last but not least, we have our latest radio show here with myself, John Robb, along with Jeff Ayers, which is a multi-reviewer, along with an author. He's been doing reviews for several years, Jeff has. And this is where we kind of go in depth and a little bit more by talking about books that we're reading, reviews on the air. You're going to hear a lot more reviews. You're going to hear a lot more detail about the publishing business, the behind the scenes look into it. How do you even get reviewed? I mean, how do you get Jeff to review your book here for the Associated Press? Along with trying to get yourself noticed to try to get in Suspense Magazine, along with other things. Because the tips and the marketing tools and the publishing business, the query letters we go into, and everything else we have, all wraps itself kind of up here into one. So you're able to have a better sense of exactly what goes on, how to get your book reviewed, how to maybe even get your book published, marketing tips, like we said, and everything else. So you want to check that out. The Story Blender is every other Friday. Beyond the Cover is every other Monday. Again, that's with myself and Jeff. And then, of course, we are still partnering up with Partners in Crime Tour to bring you Suspense Radio one-on-one. So whenever there's an author that is on tour with Partners in Crime, we have them on Sundays. It's just whenever the schedule comes out to be able to bring them to you for a little one-on-one half-hour special. So you may want to make sure that you check everything out on suspensemagazine.com. We are going to have a separate radio site up shortly that are going to have all the shows. You're going to see all the links. You're going to have the books that we maybe talk about. Of course, more in-depth on the authors and everything else for you. And there's only one place you can get it, and that is right here on Suspense Radio and suspensemagazine.com. If you have any questions, you can always email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com. You can put the show title in the subject line, what you're talking about. And anyone that you email, if you're talking about an author or you just want to talk to a host, we will make sure that we get it over to you. And again, as always, we want to thank you all for listening because without you, there would be no show and there would be no magazine. So keep listening, everybody, and we will see you all on one of the days.
So we'd like to welcome everybody here back after the break. Again, today's Crime and Science radio show is with very special guest, Dr. Emily Goff. So let's get right back into the conversation. So here's your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome back, everyone. Dr. Goff, I'm going to get into some of the nuts and bolts of what you do now. For starters, I think many people refer to almost the entire phylum of arthropods as bugs. But it's really a very complex and varied world of animals. And added to that, many of these animals take on different forms in various life stages. So how many different species are you likely to encounter when examining a set of human remains? And what factors sort of affect that?
Okay, well, that's I guess the answer to that is it all depends. there are a lot of variables that come in. Maybe start off with the idea of how many different kinds are going to show up between the moment of death and the time the body is reduced to a complete skeleton with nothing that's attractive left. And that's going to depend a lot on where you are. Good example, Hawaii. I'm in an island. I'm on an island, actually. I'm not in it yet. Probably when I'm buried or something like that, I'll be in it. But right now, I'm still on top of it. But we're isolated. And even here, between time of death and skeletonization, I'll have 300-plus species of insects and other arthropods that are going to come in and use the body in one form or another.
Wow.
If I go to a continental area, the diversity is going to be much greater. And generally speaking, you can look at 600-plus species that would show up between death and complete skeletonization. Not all of them are going to use the body the same way, and not all of them are going to be of equal significance. At the first part of decomposition, within the first week, you'll probably have initially three, maybe four species of maggots that are going to be present. These are the larvae of flies. And as time goes on, you're going to get still more insects coming in. Probably the greatest number that have been relevant that I've worked on in a case here in Hawaii was 25 species that were there that were actually using the body some way or another, either as directly as a food source. We have the necrophages that come in, those that feed directly on the body. We're going to have those that are predators and parasites coming in feeding on the necrophages. We have some adventive species that just happen to be there. We have some that are accidentals. They just fall onto the body. If the body is under a bush or something like that, some of the insects that are on the bush will wind up falling onto the body. So a lot of different relationships that will occur between the body and the insects and each other during this. So variation due to where you are. Okay. Now, here in Hawaii, I'm in the tropics, and I don't have a lot of annual variation in terms of who's there. But if I go to the mainland, season is going to have a tremendous amount of effect on the number and the kinds of insects that will be there. Also, elevation. The higher you go, the less diverse your population seems to be on the body. So these types of things. Wind is going to act as a deterrent factor. Rainfall. You get an area of heavy rainfall. This is also going to suppress the number of kinds of insects. So it's kind of variable, but there are a lot that actually will get onto that body.
So what are the typical steps you would take at an outdoor scene where the remains of an individual have been found?
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky, starting with my work with the medical examiner here in Hawaii, because I tend to go out to the scene before the body is actually moved, and I work along with people. But I'm generally not the first one that has a crack at the body. So when they do say, okay, go ahead, your turn to process, first thing I do is I have everybody pull back from the body. Because as people manipulate the body as they will sit there and process the scene. They'll disturb the body, disturbs the insects, and they leave. But they're not going to go very far because this body is their source of food. So they're going to be around. If you have everybody pull back a little bit, the insects are going to come back. So you let it settle a little bit before you do anything. And then when you do reapproach the body, go in kind of, quietly. One of the main things you need to do is sit back, let the scene talk to you. Take a look at it. See what's there, what isn't there, what should be there. Just get a general feel of what's going on with the scene. Take pictures. Okay, one of the sayings is that film's cheap. It's far better to take more pictures than you need than to suddenly discover later on that there's something you really wish you'd had a picture of, but you don't have it now. You'll see things in these pictures sometimes that you'll miss initially going over the scene. Don't rush. Okay? They're not going to get any deader. So just kind of take your time on this. You need to take temperatures. Okay, because the temperature, insect development is directly related to the temperature. The higher the temperature, the more rapid the development of the insect, the more rapid the motion of the insect. So take temperatures, take a look at the weather conditions. Okay, is it raining? Is it wind blowing? Right now, sitting here looking out the window, I've got pretty close to gale force winds going through here in Hawaii right now. Get a pretty good storm, and basically it wouldn't be an awful lot of flies out in this type of a weather. So, in fact, I'm not going out in this type of weather, but you'd kind of take a look and see what's going on. Note the type of habitat. What kind of vegetation is there? What's the terrain like? Are you on the side of a mountain, or are you in a tidal flat, what have you? And then you're going to start looking at taking your samples. And sampling, typically, you want to get a representative sample of everything that's there. You're not making any judgments at the scene as to what may or may not be significant. You want to get a sample of everything, because what looks like it's highly significant there may later turn out to be insignificant. And something that looks like it's nothing may turn out to be the most significant thing that you collect. Okay? Start with the upper areas that are exposed, and then go down and take samples as the body is moved of the lower covered areas. You want to take temperature of the soil immediately under the body. You want to take soil samples that you're going to take back to the laboratory and process in a Berlaisi or Tallgren funnel there. Basically, you're sampling everything you can possibly sample. And as you take a look at all this, you want to make sure you're going to be able to split it into two lots. One, you're going to want to keep alive. Many times you can't identify things that adequately from the immature stages, but the adults are relatively easy to identify. So you'll get them back to the laboratory, keep those alive, you'll put them on beef liver or some suitable substrate, rear them through to the adult stage at known temperatures. Okay, and the other, you're going to want to fix. Basically, you're killing them and stopping the clock, okay? And you're going to store these then in typically 70% ethanol for the immatures. Sample the surrounding vegetation. Many of the insects will be on the vegetation and come down, just to get onto the body. I typically don't sample clothing at the scene unless it's something very obvious crawling on it. I prefer to sample the clothing when I go through the autopsy procedures with the pathologist the next day. It's much easier to do this in the morgue than it is crouched out on the side of a hill or something like this. So that's a very quick sort of summation. Now, keep in mind, when I do this in a course, we're spending about probably 2.5 weeks going through this.
Yeah. Well, how would this process differ if it was an indoor scene?
Yeah. Well, to start with, you're not as worried about the vegetation.
Exactly.
In there.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. No. It's an indoor scene is going to be. Yeah. It's a really bad apartment you make. And I've been in a couple. But you don't have to worry quite as much about changing environmental conditions. You want to check the windows to make sure that they're, are they open? Are they closed? Don't alter the condition of it. What are the temperatures inside the apartment? Check and see if there's a thermostat. You got a heater going on that's keeping things in a nice, even temperature. Body processed in a similar manner. You want to check around under items that are in close proximity to the body, because many times when the maggots in particular are going to complete their development, then they're going to leave the body and go and look for some place to pupate that's a little bit away from the body. If they pupate at the body, then they can't move, they can't run away, and they're fair game for predators. So check under the things. I had, well, one case, a guy they found in, no, it was in an apartment, and it was closed pretty well. He was laying on a cot, and he had hooked himself up to a battery and a couple of other things. It was a kind of an autoerotic type of accidental asphyxia, as it turned out. And he was mummified completely. And the insects on the body just weren't making sense in terms of the length of time that the body had obviously been there. And then I looked over in the corner under a pile of clothing, and under the pile of clothing, I found all the insects that had migrated away, and they were pupating very happily, and this accounted for the entire period of time very nicely.
So forensic entomologists may be able to help determine the post-mortem interval. We kind of alluded to that with these mummified remains. But the time between death and discovery of the remains, that's obviously really important to law enforcement. So to look at some of the ways that forensic entomologists do that, what is succession, and how does a knowledge of succession help forensic entomologists determine that?
Okay, well, succession. Actually, let me clarify one thing. You mentioned that we help to determine the postmortem interval. Actually, what we determine is a period of time since period of insect activity. And very frequently there will be something on the front end of that is also part of the postmortem interval, but we really can't account for that in there. We can just deal with the period of actual insect activity on the body. And that works just with individual life cycles very nicely for the first about 14 days. By that time, everybody has left and completed their development. That's when we have to start relying on succession. And succession is actually an ecological type of a principle. And maybe the best way to describe it is to think of a volcanic island that has just come up out of the ocean. And it comes up, it's hot, it's barren, there's really nothing on it. And then pretty soon you have vegetation that starts washing on. Vegetation takes root. And as it does that, it begins to change the character of the island, and it makes it attractive to other organisms, to animals. And they'll come in, and they'll interact and feed on the vegetation, and then their presence is going to attract other groups of animals. And you have this continuous change of the island, change of the flora and fauna that are on the island, until finally you hit this point of stability. Now, a dead body is a lot like this emerging island that comes up. It's dead. It's dumped there. Like the island, it tends to be geographically isolated in most cases. And the first insects that show up are going to be your blowflies. And they're going to come in, go to the natural body openings, lay their eggs. When those eggs hatch and the maggots begin feeding on the body, then they immediately begin to change the body. And as they do that, they make it attractive to other groups of insects. These other groups come in turn, they attract other groups of insects, and this goes on and on until we've got our 300 species that I mentioned earlier here in Hawaii, or 600 plus on the mainland. Now, the difference between the body and the island is that the island hits a point of stability. Okay, the dead body goes until it's completely consumed, and then everybody leaves. Yeah, there. So what we have to do is conduct decomposition studies that, and we use typically 50-pound pigs for this, and we take very detailed notes of who is there, when they are there, and what they are doing. And then when we come to the body, again, we make representative samples of everything that is there, and then you start making comparisons between what you find on the body and what's present at a decomposition study at the same point in time, under the same environmental conditions. Okay. Typically, the closer to death you are, the narrower the parameters. The further away from death you are, then the wider the parameters. So you start off saying, okay, it's plus or minus hours to days, weeks, months. Finally, you say it's been there a long time. Okay. Generally speaking, law enforcement is not real happy with that one. They had a pretty good idea of that before they called you.
Well, you mentioned, you know, a lot of the environmental factors, rain, wind, temperature, things like that. What other things complicate this estimation of the bug interval, as you will?
Well, one of the commonest ones is people wrap the body. Okay, and wrapping the body delays the onset of insect activity, limits the number of insects that can get there. And so that's probably one of the commoner ones. If the body is indoors, you're going to have delays. You're going to have more limited types of insect activity. We'll have people that have the body in the trunk of a car, burial, burning of the body. And occasionally you get somebody that will actually spray insecticides on the body attempting to keep the insects away.
Mm. Wow.
So a wide variety. It's kind of limited by your imagination.
Yeah.
Fortunately, most
clever.
People committing murders don't really have a lot of imagination.
Or impulse control. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So... blowflies have what almost seems like a superpower to me. I once heard an anthropologist sort of jokingly say that they're on their way almost before you hit the ground. So how quickly do they arrive, and do we have any idea how they do that or what gives them that ability?
Well, deal with the first part of that question, because actually I could deal with the second one, is we're not quite sure. And they're exactly how they do it. They have a sensory system that allows them to apparently to detect death at considerable distance. They're attracted, but I don't think we really understand at this point exactly what that mechanism is. At least I haven't heard any explanations that have been totally satisfactory. In terms of how quickly, and that goes to why I don't find many of these all that satisfactory, here in Hawaii I can expect the first blowflies within 10 minutes following death, generally within the first couple of minutes, if the body is exposed. They're there. They're tremendously accurate. Of course, that's the way they're going to survive. They can only survive by ovipositing or laying their eggs on something that is dead. And day or night, I'm going to see them there.
So you've sort of mentioned this earlier. You mentioned that burial can affect it. So how does burial affect the activities of arthropods on remains, human remains?
Well, the main thing is even a few inches of soil over a body are going to severely delay the onset of insect activity, because a lot of the species really can't burrow down to lay their eggs. The larvae are not that good at penetrating down to the body. So it limits the number of species that are actually going to be able to get to the body. It's going to delay the onset of insect activity. And typically your populations on a buried body are going to be significantly smaller than what you're going to have on a surface disposal. The other thing is that as the body is buried, the deeper you go, the cooler it's going to become. And so generally this, since the development rate of the insect is going to be dependent on temperature, the cooler temperatures are going to slow things down a little bit, actually quite a bit sometimes.
Now, you talked about a case in a fly for the prosecution where there was the death of a young man at March Air Force Base back in 1992, and you made a very accurate determination or estimation of the time of death from Hawaii without even being at the scene itself. Tell us about that. That's so cool.
Yeah, well, this was actually a case that was quite interesting. It was very fortunate because the investigator for the Air Force, Steve McGibbon, actually had attended a couple of our workshops, and he knew pretty much what to do. So the relative success of this was due in large part to his activities. Did an excellent job in there. But it was a 15-year-old military dependent, and body was found in the evening, actually at March Air Force Base near Riverside in California, and had multiple stab wounds as the cause of death, along with the fact that his throat had been cut. The Riverside County Coroner's Office took charge of the body, and they moved it, put it into the crypt there, and it was held at a fairly low temperature, enough to pretty much stop the development of the maggots, and it was held until Friday in there. And the consultant collected samples of the insect, and he also went back and took soil samples from the scene and got a lot of pictures, got the hourly weather data, everything that basically I would have collected. He went ahead and he did. He did a very good job on this, and he fixed the one lot with in hot water, and then preserved it using isopropyl alcohol cut with water, and then he kept the other half of the specimens in a cardboard box with air holes cut in it, and he shipped it, sent it to via Federal Express, and in this case he sent it to my house as opposed to the lab, since it would have been a weekend, and there the postman. Still a little skittish about that, but you know, he's speaking to me again, and no Christmas things have been missing. But when a shipment got there, I took it right into my lab and I set it up and took a look at all of the different photographs that we had, and it turned out that we had maggots of both blowflies and flesh flies in there, and three species of the Caliphorids, or your blowflies, and this was your Venetia sericata, Formia regina, and Chrysomyia rufifossis. There will be a spelling test at the end of this one.
You could just do a pronunciation test and kill us.
Yeah, oh no, that never comes back the same way twice. And then we also had the flesh fly, which was a sarcophagid. That one had already gone into the pupal stage, and unfortunately, it died in the pupal stage in there. So the sarcophagia bulata is just kind of a tentative type of identification, wasn't used in any of the analyses. But taking a look at Phoenicia sericata, which was the largest of the maggots that was present there, taking a look at that, calculations indicated that somewhere between 72 and 77 hours had elapsed between the death of the individual and refrigeration of the body at the morgue, actually between the colonization of the body, which would have occurred pretty quickly. So using temperature data that was provided by the base. That's one nice thing about dealing with military bases. They get excellent environmental data, particularly an Air Force type of facility where they got planes coming and going. So I had excellent environmental data. And this indicated to me, working out just on an hourly basis, that the death occurred, or the colonization occurred probably somewhere between 10 p.m. and midnight. Now, and this was about 2.5 days prior to the, about 3 days prior to discovery of the body. So, check the specimens, Chrysomia rufa fossis, and you're actually in the same time frame. Formia regina, on the other hand, said, okay, no, been here about 2.5 days. But that actually makes perfect sense because Formia regina doesn't like to lay its eggs immediately following death, kind of likes to age the body for a little bit. So putting everything together, everything came out about 3.2 days prior to discovery of the body and basically between 10 p.m. and midnight. So I called that in. And when I did, it was just complete silence at the other end of the phone. And I thought, okay, really screwed up somehow here. It's something that they're going to start laughing pretty soon. And the guy asked me to repeat it, and I repeated it to another one. And it turns out that they had picked up several suspects, and one of them, at the time I called in, happened to be confessing to having participated in the killing. And it actually... he said they killed him around 10:30 at night. So that's you know, that's a bullseye. And that's concern. But when you go to court, we go with the 3.2 days.
Right.
Yeah.
Not going to go to the hourly basis.
Well, we are reaching the end of our time. We really hope you'll come back and talk to us again, Dr. Goff.
Absolutely.
It's been fascinating.
That's
and
good.
I want to just urge our listeners to get a hold of a copy of A Fly for the Prosecution. It's written for the general public, so you'll have no trouble grasping things. He lays everything out so clearly. If I could get a hold of it, wrap my head around it, you can, I promise. So, really wonderful stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
That was a pleasure.